We hope you're finding the first week of this Advent retreat on Living Witness has been a blessing for you. We are starting today on Chapter 2 in the book, The Four Teresas by Gina Layer. Chapter 2, St. Teresa of Avila, Loving God with Your Whole Soul. Examine yourselves to see whether you are holding to your faith. Do you not realize that Jesus Christ is in you? 2 Corinthians 13:5. Gina is now going to begin on page 24, her life.
Teresa Sanchez de Cepeda y Ahumada's life began in Avila, Spain at 5:30 a.m. on March 28, 1515. Her father, Don Alonso, said she came with the first glimmers of the light of day. This was perfect timing for a woman who would be a bright light in a struggling church during the Protestant Reformation and the Spanish Inquisition. Teresa's mother was Don Alonso's second wife. Along with a half-brother and half-sister, Teresa had six other brothers and one sister, born to the feeble Doña Beatriz, who died when Teresa was only 13 years old. Rodrigo, the closest brother in age to Teresa, was her dearest companion. The young pair frequently collaborated on secret plans, whose innocent designs often revolved around experiencing the glories of martyrdom. Teresa did not expend all her social efforts on her brother, however. Many people were attracted to her, and not just because of her good looks. She had an unusually large share of charms that she enjoyed displaying for others. She later described them as the natural graces with which the Lord had endowed her. She was clever, witty, and gifted in writing, dance, embroidery, chess, and horseback riding.
The people of Avila were of the opinion that Teresa would marry whomever she pleased, and indeed she did, although the journey that led her to be the bride of Christ was not a direct one. In her autobiography, St. Teresa shares a candid confession of the sins and weaknesses she struggled with throughout her life. She reveals how eagerly she sought the approval of people around her by dressing according to fashion, wearing jewelry and makeup as soon as she could, and being almost fixated on her appearance. Along with her vain tendencies, as a girl, she was addicted to reading books of chivalry and following the lies of their characters. Her father didn't approve of this pastime, but she would disobey him by reading them in secret. Teresa also had a tendency to foster exclusive friendships whose primary sustenance was gossip. Instead of following her older sister's example of modesty and charity, Teresa latched on to her cousin, who was not a good influence in this regard. Later, Teresa would teach that we are more inclined to follow bad examples than good ones. Leaving behind the effects of these adolescent tendencies was a difficult challenge for Teresa. But at the age of 16, she went to a girls' boarding school run by Sisters of the Augustinian Order, and there she began to grow in her knowledge of God. She also started fighting some of her sinful habits, mostly because she was afraid of eternal punishment. Teresa was not yet acting out of love for Jesus. She says honestly of her teenage years, "I was still most anxious not to be a nun." 5 more years would pass before God gave her the desire to enter religious life.
In the meantime, Teresa fell ill. The sickness progressed to the point that she had to leave school and move back into her father's house. There she spent many days confined to her bed. As she began to feel better, she decided she would prefer a different setting. So while still convalescing, Teresa moved in with her older sister Maria, who was married and had a young son. Teresa enjoyed herself immensely in her new home, playing with her nephew and improving her already noteworthy cooking skills. The experience of staying with her sister, however, did not leave Teresa with a longing for married life. In fact, her choice to join the convent was largely made during this time. She also visited her uncle, whose deep faith and spiritual conversion influenced her. Teresa did not feel an emotional attraction to being a nun, but the thoughts she began to have about the vanity of the world and the horror of hell led her to make a deliberate choice to remove herself from the temptations to her particular weaknesses. As she recalled, "I decided to make myself enter." By the time she was 21, Teresa was ready to carry out her plan. Leaving her family was a tremendous sacrifice, which only managed through the strength of her resolution. And so she became the Carmelite sister Teresa of Jesus. Although it began only as an act of her will, entering the Carmelite order would bring Teresa a deep joy that lasted throughout her whole life. Her joy was not without suffering, however. Teresa soon became ill again, and this sickness affected her more dramatically than the previous one. She had to leave her new convent home and seek treatment elsewhere. The doctor's methods were often torturous, and Teresa's health only worsened in their hands.
At one point, Teresa asked to receive the last rites, but when the priest arrived, he thought she was dead. The next 2 days, she showed no sign of life. The following day, the nuns prepared a grave for her and wrapped her body in a shroud. On the fourth day, the sisters came to take her body, but Teresa's father resisted, believing she was still alive. Sure enough, Teresa opened her eyes and immediately asked if she could make a confession and receive the Eucharist. Teresa was slow to recover from this physical trauma. She returned to her father's home, completely paralyzed, except for movement in one finger on her right hand. She was in excruciating pain for 9 months. Finally, Teresa returned to a Carmelite convent, where she lived in the infirmary for 3 years. She kept up her spirits with the attitude that she would not exchange her suffering for any treasure. She believed suffering was a gift from God to draw her closer to Him. She accepted His will for her, even if it would mean being in this state forever. The other sisters marveled at her patience during this time of trial, because it seemed impossible, were it not for God's grace, that anyone could bear so much with such great joy. Eventually, Teresa began to pray through the intercession of Saint Joseph that God would cure her so she could serve Him. Shortly thereafter, she showed remarkable improvement, and before long, she was participating once again in normal life at the convent. But as Teresa was soon to discover, life in the convent was in some ways too normal.
A Carmelite conversion. Over time, the Carmelite nuns had become lax in the observance of their rule. In place of poverty and austerity, luxury had crept in. Some of the wealthier nuns had cells that resembled small mansions, complete with fashionable furnishings and servants. The community had also abandoned many traditional practices of silence and fasting in favor of a more comfortable way of life. Perhaps the greatest problem for Teresa was that the Carmel served as a popular social center for many people, including wealthy and noble personages of the surrounding area. The sisters, especially Teresa, who was quite popular, would spend hours gossiping with guests rather than conversing with Christ. With this company, Teresa kept one foot in the secular world. She even gave up her prayer life for a time, until her father was dying and his confessor urged Teresa to return to prayer. It would be another 10 years before Teresa was ready to give herself entirely to Jesus.
During a festival the sisters celebrated in their house, Teresa began to desire to truly love Jesus and never to offend Him through sin. For this feast, the sisters had on loan a special statue of Christ for their chapel. In the 16th century, sacred works of art couldn't be mass-produced and distributed, so the arrival of this sculpture was significant. The image portrayed Christ with the wounds of His passion. Teresa wrote, "The very sight of Him shook me, for it clearly showed what He suffered for us. So strongly did I feel what a poor return I had made for those wounds that my heart seemed to break, and I threw myself on the ground before Him in a great flood of tears, imploring Him to give me strength once and for all not to offend Him again."
This was a moment of profound conversion in St. Teresa's life. She began to recognize the truth about sin, and this helped prepare her soul for the grace to complete a mystical union with Jesus. She progressed steadily in her spiritual life and in prayer from this point forward. Along with all of her soul's growth in the ensuing years, St. Teresa was also busy with another massive undertaking: the reform of the Carmelite order. 7 years after her conversion experience, on a Saturday evening in her cell, which was large and comfortable enough to entertain guests, Teresa was talking with some of her close companions when the idea came up to found a new convent, more sincerely dedicated to the pursuit of holiness and perfection. In the following days, Teresa felt God calling her to pursue this new convent and to name it in honor of Saint Joseph.
Teresa's biggest hesitation, superficial though it may have been, was that she liked the house where she was because she had arranged her cell exactly to her taste. Resisting this temptation to take the easy route, She decided to implement reforms that would be more conducive to the advancement of souls in the ways of prayer. She thus began her works of founding the reformed branch of the Carmelite order, the Discalced Carmelites. Discalced, which means shoeless, indicates the return to the austere roots of Carmelite life. Before pursuing plans for the new convent of St. Joseph, Teresa sought approval from her confessor and the Carmelite provincial, both of whom supported her plan at first. But when certain sisters in Teresa's community and members of some other orders showed resistance, these men changed their minds. Teresa faced the scorn and judgment of many who disapproved of the changes. Teresa endured this opposition courageously, finally opening the new convent 2 years later. In the remaining 20 years of her life, she would help establish 15 other Discalced Carmelite convents, including the Community of Discalced Brothers, which St. John of the Cross founded with her.
Teresa maintained many contacts in these years, during which she wrote her book of foundations. She sent letters and paid visits to priories and palaces, nobles, priests, and bishops. Some people accused her of vanity and pride, of making herself out to be more important than she was. But fame and attention did not motivate Teresa. She actually wished she had less of it. In the chapel, for example, when she felt she was about to enter into a state of ecstasy, she begged God to spare her from any public display. She was afraid others might mistakenly think she was worthy of these special graces. Teresa had no desire to be set apart as the Holy One because she believed she was far from perfect. She told a priest, "During my lifetime, I have been told that I was handsome and I believed it, that I was clever and I thought it was true, and that I was a saint. But I always knew that people were mistaken on that score." Teresa's reputation for sanctity spread, in spite of her protests, among those who weren't blinded by jealousy. Try as she might to bring her flaws to light, the light of Christ shone more brightly within her. This holy radiance shone around her and all the saints because they carried Jesus within them. Saint Teresa's life of prayer made this divine presence possible.
Wow, Gina, this is absolutely amazing. The details that you've dug up, and I'm flabbergasted. I'm shocked at a lot of the things you dug up. Makes me feel hopeful that no matter how many times I fail in my prayer life, there's always a second chance. God hasn't given up on me, and I shouldn't give up on him either. But these details.
Right. Like the buried alive scene. Doesn't that sound like something from Halloween? I mean, they're about to put her in the ground. She's that close to death. And that was prior to her doing all of this work and this incredible influence in the church. It's just remarkable when you think about moments like that.
Mary Beth, I saw you underlining and taking notes over there. What are you thinking about?
I don't know. Just a deep breath that she like had this attention to the way she looked and the way, you know, her gossip and this journey that she's had. I don't know about Veronica or Kathy, if that struck you at all, but it really gave me hope that I still have time.
Yeah, definitely both those things. The fact that even after she became a nun for so many years, she wasn't giving, you know, Christ her full attention. I think, yep, that there is hope, that look how long it took her, you know, and here she is, this great eagle, as St. Therese called her. Yeah, it does. It gives us hope that we can still imitate her and never give up in seeking the Lord.
How about you, Kathy?
I see myself in her where she was. It was talking about her reading books of chivalry back when I was a lot younger. I was reading Harlequin romances, you know, so I could identify that way. And when she was talking about the approval with people and dressing according to fashion, I have a granddaughter that is my daughter is really trying to help her with that, because she really, you know, to balance it with her love of it, but at the same time to not think so worldly about it.
Well,
so,
it's interesting because Teresa talks about she had these natural gifts and graces, right? She was beautiful. She was gifted with people. These are gifts. And I think this is part of the challenge that we have with raising our daughters, our granddaughters, ourselves, is to find the place where the natural gifts are allowed to flourish and they're allowed to become a source of light, but they don't become an end in and of themselves. And that's a challenging balance to walk, I think, for any of us. But one of the things I admire about the story of Teresa of Avila is that you see this kind of trajectory moving alongside each other. Like, she's growing in her own spiritual life, in her own conversion, in her own depth. And at the same time, she's also making strides in terms of her actions, her behaviors, ultimately her ministry. She's doing these incredible things in the church and the world, but she's still in her own personal process of development. So I don't know. It just makes me think sometimes, you know, we think we have to figure it all out at once or get to this point where we understand everything and then I'll be able to help my daughter figure this out. It's like, no, it's kind of a journey that it's all mixed together. It's all happening at once. And I see that a little bit in her life.
I think it's that both and. I always think of the Mary Martha, that it's not one or the other, that it's a combination of your interior and your exterior life and working them and intertwining them. And that's what she's showing us, that the struggle that we have, that it is right in the soul, but at the same time, we're living in the world.
And you do mention deficiencies quite a few times throughout, like talking about her life. And, you know, it makes me wonder, because I love St. Catherine of Siena. I believe it's her quote that we were designed with deficiencies, and that in that deficiency is exactly where her strength started to rise up. I mean, I see that in the physical life, you know, oftentimes when you might be deficient in maybe something, you know, you work harder at it, and then it ends up bringing about a greater good.
That's a good point, because we often want to run away, or we want to hide, or we want to bury, or we're embarrassed about the deficiencies. But having the humility to embrace them, to dig into them, and to ask God to work in with His grace there. I mean, that's back to some of what we talked about with Therese. Like, I can't love the way I'm supposed to, so you're going to have to do this in me by Your grace. And you know, we're so gifted as Catholics to have access to so many different channels, ways of tapping into that power that really is supernatural. It's beyond us.
You know, I was thinking about her public, the display of her ecstasy, which of course she has no control over. And I know it's not really an equation, but the only way I can identify with that is that I can sing and I canter at church. And I have so many people come up to me to tell me, you know, what a wonderful voice I have, but it has nothing to do with me because I was given it, right? And so what I say is my gift is just very public. And so other people's gifts might not be as public. And I keep asking for humility with it, just to make sure that it doesn't, you know, get to my head per se, you know, like she was saying that she struggled with too.
Right. And I think too, like as far as helping our daughters, you know, what a struggle we have today as parents, and they have, especially with social media, when you think of all the, you know, the focus on the outer appearance and, you know, like setting up the perfect life for, you know, Pinterest or Instagram or whatever, and all the likes and the, just how hard it is for us not to focus on the, you know, just the insecurity of seeing, you know, what everyone else is doing and do they approve of me and, you know, all of that. And just the, how that relates to, you know, even St. Teresa, you know, that looking for that approval from everyone else and how she had to learn to seek her deepest foundation in Christ and that love relationship. And then everything she was doing comes out of that instead of looking to all these things that, oh, what am I doing? What am I not doing? What's someone else doing?
You know, Veronica, that's a good point. We always think that, well, it would have been easy to be a saint back then. They don't have all the distractions and challenges and temptations that we have. But I think in reality is her temptations were just as real and just as strong and just as powerful as our social media is. Gina, do you feel that as the laity, it brings a special challenge to us?
I mean, ultimately, you know, Teresa reforms this Carmelite order so that it's austere and you can't have parties in the parlor. But as lay people, we do still have to navigate that public sphere. I don't know where this all comes together, but Kathy, I really, really like this idea of recognizing the public gifts and the private gifts. And I just wonder as lay people, how do we navigate or find that balance of having to be, you know, it's cliche, but in the world and not of the world. How do we engage and transform without being corrupted? I don't know, but that's an interesting thing for us to be pondering, I think.
I was particularly struck about the part of her life where she gave up her prayer life. So from those gossipy kinds of sessions, the enemy really started to slowly weave into her. And that was how many hundreds of years ago, and how really vibrant and screaming at me how true it is today, how quickly it is able whether it's social media or all the distractions, to give out or give up that prayer time. And especially as, you know, we're recording this in the season of Advent, and how we can just be trapped into having to do things for all the wrong reasons, and to, give up our prayer time. And what a beautiful time to stop, which is, I think, the purpose of why we're even doing this recording, is that we do take that intentional time to stop as wives, mothers, grandmothers, spiritual mothers, and just say, look, let's just be life-giving. Let's just be, let's not go the way the world is going. Let's really stop and give that attention to Christ.
Perfectly said, Mary Beth. And yes, you're right. We have so much to ponder here as we wait for the next episode to come out of our Advent journey with the Four Teresas by Gina Lair. And I guarantee you there are more surprises to come. So stay tuned as we wait for our next episode of our Advent retreat tomorrow on Living Witnesses.